Hi, Johnny. I didn't hear
Good evening. How are
you. Good
you?
evening. Fine, thank you. A little bit tired, but
Ah,
it's
you're up late tonight.
okay. Very late. Very early, not late.
Oh, yes, very early in the morning, yes.
Yeah, it's 2 a.m. now.
Wow. Did
Hi,
you get some
Tony.
sleep earlier, or
Hi, Tara.
did you get sleep earlier?
I went sleeping a couple of hours and then
Then you got up. Okay, good.
hopefully I heard the ringing the bell.
Oh, good.
It's not always so sure. Sometimes my subconscious
That's great
consciousness.
dedication. You're
Yeah.
very dedicated.
Yeah. Okay. So, should we wait some minutes, or I think there is Geoffrey said he will not be able to attend.
Shall we wait a few more minutes? Maybe Lauren is coming. I don't know. Sometimes she.
Right, Lauren, yeah.
Maybe another minute. Are you leading tonight, Marco?
Leaving?
Are you leading tonight? Are you leading the discussion?
Not necessarily leading, but I think I will do the summary.
Okay.
This is chapter 25.
Cool.
It's time. And oh, I'm not a leader. You can lead if you want.
And I'm a follower for sure.
I also normally am not, but. And Marco changed his nickname.
Yeah, he's Mindful Al now, or Mindful
Mindful
AI.
I thought that's what always showed up.
No, I saw Marco Rovelli. Yeah.
Well, you know who I am, right?
Yeah, but you have now a different haircut or something or different. So I was the first moment I was not sure, is he is or is he not?
My computer crashed, and I'm in the process of backing up a number of files, and then I'm going to reinstall the operating system and
That's why you have a different
reorg.
cut. Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
So I'm rebooting everything from scratch there. So I'm on a
Oh, it
different
must be
computer.
hurtful rebooting. You're
It
like Terminator. The Terminator needed 2 minutes.
had gotten quite unwieldy. I never had a really solid organizational scheme for all my files and my flows, and I've always kept good backups, but I've gotten a little bit sloppy. So now it's a good moment to refresh and reorganize and try to get focused, at least get the mental part focused, so that the spiritual has more room to
So
manifest.
the matrix is reorganizing because it has to make an update.
The ignorance ran into its own limits.
Or out of its limits, maybe.
Yeah. Would you like to lead the meditation?
Okay.
I do have a bell, however, but if you have
Yes, I
some
was saying
things.
I don't have the bell. So if you
Sure.
bell,
Okay.
you give the time in and time out, and yes, then there is nothing to lead.
Okay, well let's start now then. It's 5 after or 6 after, and we can go until 10 after or so.
Okay.
Okay.
So maybe we can slowly come back and begin with a summary, if you wish. Are there other issues we should solve previously? No, I think we can go ahead. Okay. Okay. Well, the chapter 25 of Life Divine of Sri Aurobindo is about the triple transformation. Triple what? Transformation in what sense? That's the question that Sri Aurobindo tries to answer in this chapter. And it is interesting that he begins by making himself a fast and quick summary of the chapter. He himself, so in some sense, he made me also a favor. And then he goes into this description and the details later. And he begins with saying that the intention of nature cannot be only that of awakening the spiritual man that to pass out from this inferior existence. This is a typical theme of Sri Aurobindo, which for him in his yoga, it's not enough to go into some nirvana or some heaven and that's it. Because there must be a farther intention in nature. He means, I think, by that there must be something, a reason why we exist in this physical plane. Because otherwise, it would make no sense if the only aim of our evolution here on Earth is that to escape Earth. For him, it is a contradiction. So he said there must be a farther intention of nature regarding our spiritual awakening. And he goes straight to the point, which he will take up later. And that is for him that bringing the delight of being in matter, the delight of being in matter. So he means by that there must be also a physical transformation. By this opening of the chapter, he then proceeds to describe directly what these three triple transformations are. And first, there is a psychic change. A psycho-spiritual transformation, which means the conversion of our whole present nature into a soul instrumentation. Secondly, the spiritual change, the descent of a higher light, knowledge, power, force, bliss, purity, into the whole being, even into the lowest recess of life and body, even into the darkness of our subconscious. Thirdly, the supramental transmutation, the ascent into supermind, and the transformation and the transforming descent of the supramental consciousness into our entire being and nature. Note that he distinguishes in this third phase, the supramental transformation, first an ascent and then a descent. So in some sense, it's almost four transformation, or one, two, three, A and B, so to speak. And he will go into that also later. So then he begins to explain the first part of this transformation, the psychic transformation, by describing what this psychic entity is. And which is that part in us that persists as our individuality from incarnation to incarnation. And it is something in us that nothing can pollute its purity. It is immaculate and luminous, the psychic being. It is something in us, that part in us, that has an attraction to things that are good and beauty. Truth, it is deeply conscious of truth and good and beauty. But at our level, at our normal, ordinary consciousness level, so the human level, so to speak, the normal, ordinary human level, we are not conscious of this being, which is our soul, so to speak. And he says we take frequently take the authority of this inner being and its intimations as the mind's own activity and closed in the mental substance. So we feel its existence, we only unconsciously, and take it for the intimations of the mind. Sometimes I believe to have some idea, some thought, which in reality does not come from my mind, but comes from the psychic being. This soul gazes the essence of all our mental, vital, and bodily experience and assimilates it for the further evolution of our existence in nature. But this action is occult and not obtruded on the soft surface. Occult here means it's not conscious for our surface consciousness. The soul in us, the psychic principle, puts forwards and develops a soul personality, a distinct psychic being. It acts on the surface life by the influences and intimations it throws up on that surface. That's what I said. Which we ordinarily experience and think of as ourselves. In reality, according to Sri Aurobindo, when we speak of ourselves, we think of our body, we think of our emotions, we think of our mind, but these are only surface sheets. Whereas our true essence, our true me, so to speak, is this psychic entity, this psychic being. And here sometimes he can also be a bit harsh, I think, because he says, we mistake our noblest emotions for soul expression. A fervor and passion of the emotional being throwing up its spray and foam of feelings, sentiments, sentimentalism, a dynamic enthusiasm of the life parts, eager responses of the physical, the thrills and excitements of nerve and body, all these influences coalesce in a composite formation which is frequently taken as the soul. So it means we live in a sort of illusion where we think our emotions, our thoughts come from our soul, but the soul stands behind and it's nothing to do with it, or not directly. But this is because also, he says, this psychic being is not already full grown in the sense that it is not impure. It is impure, immaculate, luminous, etc., but imperfect. Imperfect in what sense? He says, imperfect in its communication with its own source. In the vision of Sri Aurobindo, this psychic being is a spark of the divine. So this spark is not full grown in the sense that it is no longer in direct communication with its source, which is the divine, and which itself is a spark of. And in this sense, it is still imperfect, but in its essence is not touched by the what he calls the inferior nature of existence. But sooner or later, there must come a soul emergence in nature. Sooner or later, this psychic being must manifest itself at the surface of our being. is only when man awakes to the knowledge of the soul and feels a need to bring it to the front and make it the master of his life and action that a quicker conscious method of evolution intervenes and the psychic transformation becomes possible. So as long as we are not ready, this psychic being remains behind as a veil. When we are ready, it will come forward. Typical in Sri Aurobindo's Intrigor Yoga is this distinction in mind, vital, and physical. He speaks a being of mind, a being of light, a physical being. And there are this surface and this inner, vital, mental, and physical. But however, we as humans, we are driven, here again he goes down, we are driven mostly by an animal being nature that acts from a stream and chaos of instinctive impulses regulated by the automatism of nature. Even our seemingly deliberate choice is more of an automatism than we imagine, as long as the psychic being stands behind. I think I'm not a psychologist, but I think this fits well also with modern psychology, which knows well that most of the things that we do, think, and feel, and so on, are unconscious, subconscious reactions. We live in a sort of illusion to be driven by mind and will, that is reason. According to Sri Aurobindo, we believe to be driven by reason, but according to him, it's not. We are multi-person, he uses this word, multi-person, and we will never succeed in being masters of ourselves until the person, P, the person with P capital letter, imposes itself on our multi-personality and governs it. But we will never be able to do that by the surface mental will and reason. We must go within and find the central being, the psychic being. And as long as this psychic being does not surface, he distinguishes between the physical man and the vital man. The physical man is the one dominates the mind, will, and action, where the physical dominates the mind, will, and action. Whereas by the vital man is an interesting description. Here I would like to, the vital man is concerned with self-affirmation, self-aggrandizement, life enlargement, satisfaction of ambition and passion and impulse and desire, the claims of this ego, domination, power, excitement, battle and struggle, and so on. And that's this vital ego. And I think this description fits well. Many people I personally know. So then finally, there's more the mental man, the intellectual, who lives predominantly in the mind, the professor, I would say, something like that. And this is a description of the unawakened psychic being in the typology of human beings that we know well nowadays. However, mind, in spite of its power, is often impotent before the inconscient and subconscious, which obscure its clarity and carry it away on the tide of instinct or impulse. We are easily fooled by vital and emotional suggestions into giving sanction to ignorance and error, to wrong thought and to wrong action. Even if mind becomes strong and clear and dominant, and can impose a certain mentalized harmony, it cannot integrate the whole being and nature. This I like especially what he says. I think it fits very well to our society. We think to solve all our problems by pure mental rationality, technology, science, and won't be enough, according to Sri Aurobindo. At its highest, the thinking mind feeds, however, This is an advantage, he says, where the first contact with the psychic being can be fostered, can be helped by the mind, because at its highest, the thinking mind feels that behind the veil of appearances, there is a supreme truth, a supreme good, a supreme beauty, a supreme purity, and supreme bliss, other than what humans usually conceive and bears the increasing touch of an eternity and infinity, less and less impalpable and abstract, and more spiritually real and concrete. So he says, mind at its highest can gain a contact with its inner being. And that's also what I think we are seeing, also on a collective scale, at least in our days. Before going over, he then makes a little interlude where he tries to describe what he means by integrality in his yoga. What means exactly integral for Sri Aurobindo? And he begins with one part of it where he puts together the yoga of the mind, first of all, the mental approach of the yogin, then the bhakti yogi and the karma yogi. Or I would say the first is the yoga of the mind, what we call raja or jnana yoga, the mind of the sage, the higher mental thinker, the spiritual sage, who can attain higher states of consciousness by a direct contact with the spirit. The mind enters a vast, formless, and featureless impersonality and becomes aware of the unchanging self, the sheer spirit, the pure barrenness of an essential existence, the formless, infinite, and the nameless absolute, an experience that exceeds all dualities to the experience of a supreme oneness, infinity, eternity, or other ineffable sublimation of the mind's ultimate and extreme percept of self or spirit. But he says in his yoga, this is only one part of the yoga. There is also the other part of the yoga, the classical so-called bhakti yoga. The bhakti yoga is this, where he says, he introduces this by saying, however, this transformation through the mind does not give us the integral transformation. The contact with the supreme existence must come not only from mind, but also through the emotions. And in order to achieve a more integral transformation, mind must go beyond impersonality to the awareness of the supreme personal being. It is a way of the devotee, or bhakta. It is through a love and adoration of the all beautiful and all blissful, the all good, the true, the spiritual reality of love that the approach is made. This God ecstasy, the love of God, can transform also the other parts of our being. It is this which leads to a change of nature. And thirdly, there's also the karma yoga approach, the approach of the yoga of works. Also consecration of the will in works must exist. This as a tool to eliminate the ego will and its motive power of desire. It offers its will and acts to the divine, the sadhak, the practitioner of yoga has to offer its will and acts to the divine being as an instrument. In the end, by this way, one arrives at the consciousness in which one feels the force of presence acting within and moving or governing all the actions, and the personal will is entirely surrendered or identified with the greater truth will, truth power, or truth presence. So he brings this together and says, a combination of all these three approaches, the approaches of the mind, the approach of the will, the approach of the heart, creates a spiritual or psychic condition of the surface being and nature in which there is a larger and more complex openness to the psychic light within us. A composite perfection of the saint, the selfless worker, and the man of spiritual knowledge. just an interesting summary about what his yoga is meant by integral, but he says it's not just putting together all the yogas, the classical yogas, into a pot, and that's integral yoga. In his yoga, there is something more, and where one goes beyond, but first he says also, he gives a method. So this is all very nice and well, but what have we to do practically in practice? He suggests the method of detachment from the insistence of all mental and vital and physical claims and calls and impulsions, a concentration in the heart, austerity, self-purification, a rejection of the old mind movements and life movements, rejection of the ego, of desire, rejection of false needs and false habits, are all useful aids to this difficult passage. But the strongest, most central way is to found all such or other methods on a self-offering and surrender of ourself and of our parts of nature to the divine being, the Ishvara. Then the soul begins to unveil itself. The psychic personality reaches its full stature. This is in life divine, we find less advices about the practice. The more advices in this sense you can find in the synthesis of yoga. He remains at the philosophical level and or a descriptive level. And the next thing that he describes is a first result. A guidance, a governance begins from within, which exposes every movement to the light of truth, repels what is false, obscures, obscure, opposed to the divine realization. Lighted up with the unerring psychic light, all is purified, set right, the whole nature harmonized, modulated in the psychic key, put in spiritual order. And the second result is a free inflow of all kinds of spiritual experience, experience of the self, experience of the Ishvara, and the divine Shakti, experience of cosmic consciousness. However, he says, or as he goes up a ladder and tells you about wonderful things at that stage, you think that's the final thing, and no, every time he says there is a step more to go forward, a yet even higher spiritual transformation must intervene, namely by an ascent of consciousness into the ranges of overmind and supramental and supramind. To do that, there must be first an opening, a first wide awareness from below. If we open our vision, we see there is an infinity above us, an eternal presence on infinite existence, an infinity of consciousness, an infinity of bliss, a boundless self, a boundless light, a boundless power, a boundless ecstasy that we can see by opening from below, from where we are now. Secondly, there is an ascension. It is about an ascension of the mind to the heights above, a knowledge and experience of superior planes of existence. The mind rises into a higher plane of pure self, silent, tranquil, illimitable vastness. This is a spiritual transformation. This is, so we have gone from the psychic transformation to the spiritual transformation. And thirdly, there must be an effectual permanent descent of the higher into the lower nature, an increasing inflow from above, an experience of reception and retention of the descending spirit or its powers and elements of consciousness. A light descends and touches or envelops and or penetrates the lower being, the mind, the life, or the body. Or a presence or a power or a stream of knowledge pours in waves or currents, or there is a flood of bliss or sudden ecstasy. the contact with the supraconscious has been established. So then he finally, he goes to the short description of the last stage of this triple transformation, namely the supramental transformation, because he again, he says, nature, however, will not be satisfied with a summary triumph. That's what he described until now. Yeah, would like to have this summary triumph myself. Each minutest portion and movement must either be destroyed and replaced if it is unfit, or if it is capable, transmuted into the trees and to the truth of the higher being. Because even not the overmind can really convert or perfect the material existence. And that's the last stage of the integral yoga of Sri Aurobindo, the transformation, the material transformation. Because what he described until now was the transformation of the vital, the mental, a partial transformation of the physical, but not a real supramental transformation. And he says, only supermind can thus descant without losing its full power of action, for its action is always intrinsic and automatic, its will and knowledge identical and the result commensurate, its nature is a self-achieving truth consciousness. The whole radical change in the evolution from a basis of ignorance to a basis of knowledge can only come by the intervention of the supramental power and its direct action in Earth existence. The truth consciousness finding evolutionary nature ready, if it finds it ready, has to descant into her and the nature and enable her to liberate the supramental principle within her. So he said the supramental principle is already here. And so must be created the supramental and spiritual being as a first unveiled manifestation of the truth of the self and spirit in the material universe. That's the distinctive difference between Sri Aurobindo's yoga and most, at least, yogas, that he aims also at to a transformation of the material universe, our material body. Yeah. Through the action of this supermind in this third supramental transformation. So this was more or less the summary. I find it interesting that this last stage, which is perhaps in Sri Aurobindo's point of view the most important stage, he usually devotes to it only a few lines at the end of the chapters, and he leaves it not very clearly, the description is not very detailed usually, but there are probably more complex reasons for that. Okay, so this is my summary. If you wish, you can intervene, comment, or ask questions.
Good work, Marco.
Thank you.
Agreed. That was fantastic.
I thought this was amazing. This was one of the gems of this whole book. So I thought the last chapter was pretty good, and this one. So the triple transformation, this chapter was added later on, as far as I know, and it was added after they had some experience with in the ashram, and they also practiced a lot of his integral yoga, and it's basically based on a lot of experience with this, which is interesting. So this was this chapter in particular. So when I will come back and read this stuff, this is one of the ones that I would pick out.
Yeah, interesting. Thank you, Tony. I didn't know that it was added later. That's interesting. I will investigate this. Thank you for this hint.
So, you know, the way that I understand it, and I thought the last week about it, is it's basically a three-part process, right? So the first process is, he calls it the, the stabilization of the psychic being, which means you have a sense of self that is kind of interior, right? And you have what he calls purusha, which is the basically witnessing consciousness. And you have a sense of, you know, I'm here and I'm in my body and I have kind of a control of my body. And normally you're kind of in a state of, you know, I have no control at all. So you could actually take it as a four-part process where the first step is step zero, which some, you know, psychologists call the primary process, which is kind of this bubbling, booming confusion of everyday mind where your mind is kind of scattered all around, totally confused. And so, and the secondary process is one of rationality. So you basically gather your interior, let's say, mental powers and transform kind of to this inner sense of being. And that's the first one. The second one is basically a sense of self-mastery. So you have those interior unconscious drives and all the stuff going on, and you master your own psychology, and you master your own kind of inner physical and vital stuff in the mental. So it's self-mastery. And the second part of the transformation of those triple transformations is one, a transcendence, and also then a devotional kind of yoga, you know, this bhakti or whatever he calls it. And that's basically that's the higher mind. So that's the second step. And then if you got that, then there's something kind of completely different that's nowhere else. And it's the third transformation, which is basically, I don't know, it's very, very strange, but it's a different type of being in the world where kind of, I don't know, the purusha or like the divine shines through. And it's very, very, kind of a very holistic perception of the world, but you have to clear out basically in the first and second step your whole being to even come there and to even perceive the world in that way. It's very, very difficult, but it's a shining through of the purusha, shining through of the transcendental self into the world. And I think at the higher stage, you also get kind of this descent from above somewhere. I don't know, but you know, there's involution, evolution, and kind of this. I don't know, you feel the involutionary force coming from above somehow. I don't know, that's the thing, somehow how he describes this. Yes, that's the triple transformation. And the third part, it's totally strange. I don't know, I mean, you know, I think it's kind of like, if you, for example, if you look at the mountain, right? So the mountain is always there. It will always be there. And that's somehow like everything else appears in the same way. So it's just the existential aspects of life. Just why is there something instead of nothing? You know, this type of questions, you know, can be answered kind of in this existential realization, not in a mental way, but you're just out there, right? So I don't know, that's somehow how I understand this. And the third thing, it's very rare, you know, you usually don't find it. You only find it, I think, in some philosophers, but most people don't look at the world like that.
Yes, as if I might add to the psychic being, I think we have more or less all have had the experience of what this psychic being is. And if you read the synthesis of yoga, or also in the letters of yoga, he describes it very well, what it is, a bit more down to earth, less abstract, what you read in the Life Divine. And it is that part in us which is identified with the fourth chakra behind the heart. It is not the physical heart, but it is behind the physical heart, in the spine, in the fourth chakra. And there, when it shines through, one has the experience of a divine love. That's the psychic being. There's something in us that is conditioned, not conditioned, is divine love. But since we are living in this physical sheet and mental sheet and vital sheet, which is still not transformed, it veils it all, and therefore we are not directly. And sometimes we mistake human love, for example, as a manifestation of our soul, whereby in reality it is a manifestation of our vital being, sometimes also the lower vital being. And the characteristic aspect of the psychic being is this sense of love and beauty, and he what I described before. Whereas the supramental consciousness, once there was some of his disciples asking, not mother, no, not Sri Aurobindo, but mother, her spiritual companion, what is the main characteristic of the supramental consciousness? And she said two things. First, the sense of unity. Everything is one. So you see the Brahman in all. And secondly, the perfect, unperturbable equanimity. That I didn't expect this. So the supramental consciousness is that which gives you, at least in the inner, your inner spirit, in your inner being, the perfect equanimity in front of everything that can happen in your life. Only when you reach that, then this is one of distinct characteristics of the supermind. But generally, it is also it's this vision of oneness and unity of everything, also in the material existence. There are no separation between me and this table, between me and you, between me and this PC or monitor. This is only the manifestation of one being to itself. Something that for the mind does mean nothing, for the higher consciousness in the supermind becomes as something as self-evident. So I've spoken too much. I let it to you.
It's a self-evidence that comes from the outside.
Well, I have a question for the group regarding the understanding of how the supramental or the supermind functions in nature. Because after the first two transformations, he describes the supermind as, in the previous chapter, becoming a ruler and possessor of nature, of taking up nature into its own activity. Here he's I think he mitigates that view, and he says that consciousness goes where it has to go and operates in the terms of that particular area. It can't divide things out, and it can't kind of force something to grow into a higher stage. It has to work with it where it's at and enter into that area, and then also withdraw and operate more broadly. What we see now, historically, I think, in terms of the way that human beings, mental human beings, have established a civilization on the planet and are, you know, running things, are interacting with nature. I think that he's saying that the supramental would transform that, so that rather than the mental messing up nature as it's done, although it can also you know, use nature productively and so forth, the supramental would have a completely different approach. And one of the things he says in this chapter as well is that part of what distinguishes or the transition to this, to the psychic being, is that the supramental or the spiritual becomes distinct from the mental. It isn't confused with it anymore. And so because it's not confused with it anymore, it can begin to purify, you know, or reconfigure, you know, the other aspects, use as instruments, the mental, the vital, the physical, in its own design or for its own will, purpose, its own delight. So I'm curious about how others see this happening historically, or potentially is this something that doesn't exist historic, doesn't happen historically in this, in the sense of what do we mean by history, even if we're saying this, because of course the supramental is not, in my, at least I understand, not outside of, it's not that it's not present now. It's not that it's not already the case, already, you know, the occult truth. But as far as lived experience, it's not exactly that. So I'm curious how you understand the way that this third transformation really unfolds, particularly since Aurobindo said so little about it, as you pointed out, Marco.
I would assume that he, with the way that he expounds upon issues, he'll get back to this, I'm sure. But I don't know how to answer your question, but I'm pondering how the individual or the supramental individual, how that's different from the supramental consciousness or the all-encompassing. So how does the individual play into that supramental realm? If the individual is with all, unity with all, so I guess that perhaps goes into the Sat Chit Ananda part of it. That's what I'm thinking about.
He does at one point, and I'm not, I don't want to dig for the quote, but he does at one point distinguish between this supramental coming into individuals as these sort of isolated cases, and on the other hand, it becoming normalized. I think he makes that point with respect to the kind of spiritual experiences and the kinds of things that are in Future of the Body, actually, like that list that John posted. He gives a very similar list in this chapter, but he says that, you know, mostly that happens like in the dispersed way or in unique cases, and the reign or the you know, the predominance, the coming into fullness of the supramental would mean that would really be just normal. It would be kind of what happens or what's understood to happen. And it would be on the way towards this third transformation. And so that is so radical, I think. And that's part of why this question is intriguing to me and very interesting to me. Because when I start to get a sense for like the implications of what he's saying, of what the supramental means, it shifts my perspective, I guess, you know, shifts me out of a perspective on what I think that could mean or what I thought that could mean.
So I think it's a universal process that he describes there, and it's an organic process, and it happens all the time, and it happens. So this growth process from mental to vital, from physical to vital to mental to conscious and superconscious, it happens thousands of years ago. Even if you like read some of the ancient Greeks, they landed there without doing any yoga, and some of those people developed positions that do come from a higher mind, so even what he describes as the supermental. So I mean, you think it's already here in some sense, and it's already even up to, you know, the highest realization. You could find some things of that in culture, and it's just a matter of you know, numbers in a general population. So there are people who think just totally different about space and time, and they're serious people, they're smart people, and you can trace this back to the ancients. So I think in some ways it's already here. And I mean, people don't necessarily aim for it, but they land there, I think, in some way.
In regards to the historical aspect of it, and maybe what part of what you're saying right there, Tony, was that various cultures, various individuals at various time periods seem to have greater, not necessarily greater access, but seem to have honed in. They had this integral knowledge. And they had it, maybe even the experience, the culture was enough to allow that knowledge to manifest, and in a lot of modern culture, we seem to be thwarted, either on an individual level, but even culturally, it's going to be a massive undertaking. That's why we like our little pods, our little groups, 'cause here we can take this knowledge and hopefully bounce it out into the real world. I guess that's the energy part or the will. But on a unfathomable supermental level, perhaps there have been some cultures or some individuals that allowed some culture to form perhaps a perfect action, the formation of a pyramid or some great work of art, whatever it might be. And 2,000 years later, it's just going to be, it could be a piece of paper that somebody decides to crumple up and throw in a tomb for 500 years. So it might not be received by the next group of individuals or group of cultures. So it's that's the challenging part for us as mental, vital, physical individuals, is that there's constantly a lot of work to do.
That's what the Aurobindo ashram wanted to do, right? They wanted to establish a higher consciousness and bring it into the world. So really something they wanted to really bring or ascend and then descend a higher consciousness into the world. And that's what the mother, I think, tried to do very much. But, you know, when I was reading this read this a couple of hours ago. I thought about, I mean, there were maybe similar things, maybe not on the quality of this third transformation, of the triple transformation, maybe not the superminds, but maybe on the level of the second transformation, on this devotional devotional bhakti type of religiosity towards a, not a personal god, but a you know, a revelational form of religiosity or spirituality, whatever. I mean, that's quite widespread, I think. And there were movements in Christianity, for example, who I think were, you know, pretty much on the same type of if you would rate it in level, they would, on the same type of higher minds, and you know, they saw in their culture and in their manifestation of this similar things. So not in India, but here. So I don't know. I mean, for example, I mean, you know, after the Reformation age, we had a lot of movements. I thought about this, you know, Jakob Böhme or someone like that. You know, someone who you know, had a great revelation and wrote it down, and it became kind of a movement even in Europe. So I think it's actually quite something like this is actually quite widespread. Sorry, I didn't answer your question.
Well, we don't have to answer that question. We can go on to any other thoughts that folks want to bring up.
But maybe I can try to give a perspective as I read Sri Aurobindo about this point, that if and how the supramental acts also in our collective consciousness. He says this frequently. He says that the supramental is always there, but it acts behind a veil. It cannot act directly. It must act indirectly, because if it imposes itself in its full power now, as we are now in our actual state of evolution and our actual state, natural state, we would not be able to bear it. We will not. Also, at a physical level, we probably die. I don't know. Our bodies would explode. I don't know. But he said it is too much power, and it's this supramental force keeps itself, restrains itself from intervening fully. It does it only in very few occasions. I don't know if this goes into the direction of your question, but this is what came to my mind.
I think I have this pretty often. So those kind of shivers of transcendence, shivers of something shining through, where you for a moment see extremely clearly and then it's gone. But I think maybe it's the superminds. Maybe it's the sense of something, maybe not.
We might need special sunglasses if we were being blasted by the light of the supermind. He does talk about a lid, sort of lid that the overmind is, and then the rifts in the lid or the openings in the lid kind of come through. I thought that was interesting.
Well, in order to really get there, I think you must, you must do a lot of things. There are a lot of things that hold you back from really experiencing this third transformation. I mean, your whole physical, mental, vital drives that are always part of everyday interaction. It takes great discipline to arrive there, and I think only very few make it there. And for the rest of us, it's just glimpses of something higher, something bigger.
But there were two methods that he gave, which I think, Marco, I don't remember whether you or Tony pointed out. One of them had to do with basically the removal or the kind of withdrawal of the purusha from the prakriti, so that, you know, that pure witnessing is realized, and then, you know, then one isn't, as that pure witness, subject to all of the, you know, the workings of the ignorant and of the other aspects. But the other was the offering of all of those aspects to the Ishvara, right? And that seems quite a different approach, because one doesn't have to completely separate, right, from the divine, from the manifestation, from the. And so, you know, I think it's interesting, because it's not as ascetic. I think it's not as an ascetic type of approach, and I found that interesting. I don't have much more to say about that, other than this notion that the divine wants to come down, it wants to come through us. So in a way, we have to just let it, right? And to let it, we have to give it all the parts of our being that it may want to use for its manifestation. Sometimes the language here, when it gets too hierarchical, that scares me a little bit. But when it's more, when he's more careful about that, I think, oh, that sounds good. You know, we could work with the infinite. He also speaks here about the incursion or the invasion of the infinite. That's I think what he says. Which reminds me of Jean Gebser, who speaks about time as an eruption. It's that kind of a violence in the way that it comes in. So the notion that if you can land in the heart, if you could be seated in the psychic being in that heart space, then all of these things become offerings. They become offerings to the divine, that one doesn't have to isolate, you know, from them. Which I think is one of the, I mean, I think he says that one could do that. That's a potential path, but it's not the integral path ultimately, because the integral has this, you know, this wholeness to it. So all of the aspects are become offerings to the supramental being in its descent. And we are it, right? I mean, that's the we can't get there too easily either, right? We need this whole historical process, I guess.
Marco, you said it is a different approach, this approach of the Bhakta, no? Which I agree, it is very different. But Sri Aurobindo, just in this chapter, and I tried to make this summary, where he distinguishes also between these three types of yogas, the mind, the yoga of the mind, the yoga of the heart, and the yoga of the works. But for him, they are different and yet make part of a unique yoga, and that's, in this sense, it is This is one aspect of integrality of this integral yoga, where you have very different types of yogas, but nevertheless, in his vision, there are three aspects of one single yoga. So it's this ascension through the heart is very different, yes, but there is no contradiction with the ascension of the mind. They come both. And not necessarily first or the second person. There are no serial temporal successions in this sense. It can be mixed at the same time. If I may go back shortly, if someone else doesn't have something to say to something else. Okay, Doug, go ahead. Yeah.
Very briefly on what you just said, maybe the heart center kind of is a release, or allows for the psychic being to be released. And then the other aspects coincide with that as well. I don't know. That was just a quick thought.
Yeah, I think you put it well. The Bhakti Yoga is a release of the heart, and the yoga of the Raja Yoga, the Jnana Yoga, is a release of the mind. And in a certain sense, we may also say, did not say Sri Aurobindo, you didn't put it in these terms, but we may say that the supramental material transformation is the release of the body. So in this sense, you have the integrality. I skipped a point that may be relevant to what we were discussing previously. What would happen if a higher force in general, not only supermind, but also a higher stage of the consciousness, would inrush in our nature if the nature is not transformed? I previously skipped this because of time. Otherwise, the summary would have been too long. But if I may read this, it may shed some light, because the supramental does not manifest as it is immediately. Because Sri Aurobindo cautions also us. He says we must be cautious in this transformation, because if the mind, vital, and body are not ready, one might fall into an obscure battlefield full of secrets, treacherous and misleading, or open and violent oppositions. Beings and voices and influences may appear to the inner sense and vision and hearing, and claiming to the divine being, to be the divine being, or his messengers or powers and godheads of the light or guides of the path to realization, while in truth they are of a very different character. And we are left wondering about an intermediate chaos of experiences and fail to find his way out into the true realizations. These dangers can be surmounted only if there is a complete sincerity, a will for purity, a readiness for obedience to the truth, for surrender to the highest, a readiness to lose or to subject to a divine yoke the limiting and self-affirming ego. Then he says also, in the absence of any or of a complete psychic emergence, experiences might lead to a magnified ego, an uprush of the titanic or demoniac cosmic inferior characters. So the awakening to the existence of these higher supernormal levels must come only when there is a full psychic emergence, because otherwise dangerous. So I think this summarizes quite well why this higher states of consciousness, higher powers stand back and don't intervene directly, but only behind a veil.
People are at different levels of maturity, right?
Well, one of the other ideas he brings up in connection to this and the, you know, the dangers of those eruptions, if there isn't, say, that, you know, maturity, is the idea of a guide. He doesn't use the term guru, so I'm curious what he means by guide. And at the same time, it seems that the guide is only necessary insofar as the psychic being hasn't fully emerged, because if the psychic being fully emerges, then the psychic being essentially is the guide.
I think he talks about a spiritual teacher, like the mother or someone like that, who will guide you to higher planes at some level, at some time.
Yes, but also Sri Aurobindo had a, for a short time, a teacher, a master, a guru, or whatever you might call it, as it was, Lele was his name, and he helped him to realize the Nirvana. And then later, you can find it also in not here, but in the records of yoga, he was guided by the master of yoga, he called it, or this master of yoga called himself as such, don't know. And so in a way or another, we all need some teacher or guru, but it may be, as you say, the psychic being, it is an inner teacher, or not necessarily someone physical. Life is a guru. All life is yoga, he said. Hi, Lauren.
Hi, I totally agree with that. I was just thinking, you know, it could be something like an animal messenger, just life experiences, even. I feel particularly drawn to animal messengers as my, like, spirit guides. There's so much we can learn from them, and if we just think about, like, what that animal does and how it exists in the world, and you can see that same kind of us leading you towards, like, the ideas of Nirvana and such. You think about the medicine of, like, a butterfly. I was talking to my son about that today, and like, how does a caterpillar become a butterfly? He says it goes into his cocoon. and just think about that, like going within and like being still and patient and letting this transformation occur to the point where now it's a butterfly, completely different form than it was before. Probably consciousness as well, so it's seeing the world completely different at that point. Oh yeah, music too. And that's something that we've had for a long time in our history. That's a passion.
You know, until the second transformation, I get this very well. I get this. It's very kinesthetically alive. You know, when I read this devotional part, I got it somehow. You know, I can relate to this, you know, in many ways. So, but then if it goes up into this third transformation, you know, it kind of blanks out. I mean, I don't have the clarity to see how, you know, I don't know. The clarity isn't there for me. I mean, you know, I can kind of devote myself, you know, in this transformational way, but I don't know what arises then, you know. And I'm raised religious and, you know, I think about these things, but I don't know about this third transformation. And I have read a lot like this month on this. You know, I think Hegel describes it as a coming back to oneself in a certain way. You know, as a you know, same as like a return to spirit, a return to source. Something arrives back at itself, but now from a higher point of view. So you're in a sense at the start, but now you have this larger view in a sense, and it's an ongoing process. At least for Hegel it was. But you start fresh in every moment, so it's an ongoing process, but I don't know, every moment is basically you know, a beginning and an end, so I don't know how to say it. I think that's the point where a lot of the poetic language and, you know, poetic words actually make sense at that point when you get to the third transformation.
One of the things Aurobindo talks about in this chapter as well is the way in which spiritual experiences kind of, you know, can come and go. And there could be these repetitions or these, you know, this accumulation, but that over time they become more normal. So the mind or the center of awareness becomes more seated there, becomes at home, if you will. there, and that's one of the signs, that's the emergence of the psychic being. It happens in those experiences. It's there behind the veil, but as the experiences become more continuous, less like peak states and more like stable structures, like Wilbur uses that states and structures language. I think it's a little bit, it's implicit here perhaps as well. I'm curious what your experience is of this psychic being. Do you feel that it's behind the veil in you, or do you feel like it's emerged or emergent? If it's possible to, I think in Aurobindo it's sort of, can be very veiled, it could be partially emergent, it could be fully emergent. How does that feel for you?
Feels like it's always there, but sometimes I'm better at being aware of it and having it be present with me than others. Like sometimes it seems like I'm just right in tune with everything that's happening, and other times I can feel like I'm totally lost in the dark. But it's like a constant practice. Like you were saying, Tony, it's like always happening. It's like the beginning and end at the same time, like you were saying. Emerging constantly. What a practice.
You know, what he calls the psychic self is basically a witnessing self, right? It's a thing that witnesses. So, I can remember just thinking about, identity or my identity, or just in a little bit of a, philosophical way. So, many people have done this, just thinking, am I identified with my body? Am I identified with, you can look at this in many ways. So in terms of name, place of birth, and so on. And there are some people who have thought about this a little bit more sophisticated than others, and sometimes just stumble upon people who are obviously more deep than others. And I'm always fascinated by how, philosophers can think about identity in a way that is kind of, goes even like beyond, my wildest fantasies in a sense, and I think if we hadn't books, if we hadn't, communication, you actually couldn't guess that other people would actually have the same type of thoughts, or same type of, kind of deep inquiry into this. So I don't know, I stumbled upon, the way like someone like David Hume would think about identity, right? So he says something like, for example, people don't know, you actually don't know when or where you're born. You actually get told where you're born. So maybe you think like, I'm born, at that place, at that time, but it could be wrong. Sometimes it's wrong. Sometimes people, gets to, they think, I'm born there, but then they find out, oh no, I'm born at this hospital in this city, at that day, and sometimes the date doesn't actually fit. And people, if you look back like hundreds of years before the modern age, they actually didn't know when there were people who didn't know when they were born, so they didn't have this type of, they couldn't identify with you know, a birthday or something like this. And you know, I think, okay, so okay, where would you then place it, like something like identity? And like obviously, like identity is something, you know, kind of you go back, and it's just something kind of a witnessing capacity that identifies with something. I mean, you know, and you could identify with this or with that, and you know, what's really real is, in a sense, just this witnessing capacity. So I don't know. I can remember having those thoughts like very, very early on. So, and that's the Purusha. That's the that's the transcendental self. That's the witness. That's what, in his sense, kind of this transcendental being, and you know, people have ruminated and stumbled upon this a lot, and have expanded on this a lot. So at least the philosophers have. I'm not very consistent.
Well, I got that from this chapter. That reminded me that the Purusha is essentially a dividing being. So that's the first division, you know, between observer and observed. Right? The Purusha says, "I'm not that." So that's still, I think, the over mental, if I understand that correctly. And so that's really where identity, the sense of I, a being, right, since I am, like manifest, like becomes, you know, comes into being, if you will, through that. I know Wilbur would call that the original self-contraction. There's a subtle contraction in the Purusha, in the witness, because it's not, hasn't, in a sense, surrendered, you know, that that separateness, that dividing action, hasn't surrendered that to the Ishvara, to the integral being.
I think we need Debashish here. Because I think it's a matter of classification and nomenclature, I think. And I'm not sure that Purusha and the psychic being, in the view of the integral yoga of Sri Aurobindo, are the same thing. As I understand it, the psychic being is the Purusha is, as you said, I'm not sure about that, but the Purusha is, I think, the first projection of an individuality by the Brahman from the cosmic consciousness, so to speak. But it is still a universal being, whereas a psychic entity is just that individual in each of us. It is an individualized part of the divine. That's why I said, Sri Aurobindo calls it a spark of the divine. And the characteristic of the psychic being is just that tendency to perceive and see and feel everything on a base of love, beauty. And that's why the Bhakta reaches probably the psychic being sooner and easier than the Jnana, the Gnana yogi, the yogi of the knowledge, so to speak, who is in contact with the spiritual part, the higher chakras, so to speak. The psychic being is in the fourth chakra, the chakra of love, divine love. Whereas the Raja Yogi tends to go to the states of consciousness beyond mind. And there you have the, so you get to a level of consciousness where you are the detached observer, which and where you have this realization of the Advaita Vedanta, where everything is one without a second. So there are, I think, relations, and they are these two experiences overlap somehow. And I don't think we should classify it so with a knife, but I think these are two different experiences: the spiritual experience, that spiritual in the sense of Sri Aurobindo, and the psychic opening. They are two different things, I think. And when Sri Aurobindo speaks of spiritual, also the supramental, the psychic, the opening of the psychic being is also a spiritual experience, of course. But he uses only this name spiritual for the opening to the higher states of mind, illumined mind, intuitive mind, over mind, and super mind. Whereas the opening of the psychic being is here.
I hope that Matteo would be here today.
He's feeling the 2 a.m. to 4 a.m. o'clock time of Europe too, as well. He's in Europe, so he's tired.
I've been thinking about this. I find a lot of this very beautifully written, a lot of wisdom in the text, and I hear a lot of wisdom in, coming from the group as well. So it's very enjoyable, but I feel a lot of reluctance to talk out loud about certain things, because I think it was Frost who said, you should not wear for apparel what was intended as a curtain for the inmost soul. And Jesus also said, do not throw your pearls before swine. I think these, and Aurobindo talks about the secret place. So I think there are, and I think we're all exploring boundary conditions, because we could read this text by ourselves, but we've decided to come together and explore it in a communal way. So, and I think there's that public-private, the boundary between the public and the private is very fluid, especially in the times that we're living in, where things are very turbulent. And I think our culture is wobbling quite a bit. And I believe that I know my identity wobbles quite a bit from day to day. But my feeling is, I was reading this, it's a beautiful passage. I love that. I think you've referred to, Marco, if the rift in the lid of the mind is made. What happens is an opening of vision to something above us, or a rising up towards it, or a descent of its powers into our being. And then later, a couple of paragraphs later, he goes on to talk about the spiritual impression abides after these, after the lid is opened. But the mental record is often blurred and remains as a vague or fragmentary memory. The lower consciousness from which the ascent took place falls back to what it was, with only the addition of an unkept or a remembered but no longer dynamic experience. This can be very upsetting. You have these openings, and then you have to go back to chopping wood and carrying water, or you go to that wonderful retreat, spiritual experiences you have, but then you go back to your daily life and things return back to where they were. And actually, they're kind of worse than they were because you've had a glimpse of something different. So I think these are very familiar experiences for people, whatever spiritual path you're on. There are openings and then there are closings. So it's learning how to be with both. I think this is what he says here. These ascents take place for many in trance, but are perfectly possible in a concentration of the waking consciousness, or where that consciousness has become sufficiently psychic at any unconcentrated moment by an upward attraction or affinity. Once again, all this descending, ascending kind of language, I find a bit exaggerated, and for me, I would call it masculinist. It's too much like, you know, squeezing something and it goes up and out, or it comes down and in. I understand it because I know if you've ever had these Kundalini experiences, they're very, sometimes very subtle, but sometimes they're not subtle at all. They're incredibly dramatic. And they can be extremely painful. I had one experience, which I will share, and because I was in my mid-20s, and I had just gotten back from a retreat, and I was sitting in my lotus pose on my couch, and I just sort of opened myself up to the highest quality of energy. And I felt like my body temperature seemed to drop. And I was just opened up to this golden light. And then next thing I knew, I opened my eyes and I was on the other side of the room. And I was on the floor and I had blood going down my, I had cut the corner of my eye and my cheek where I had hit a shelf. So it looks like I had somehow flown across the room and landed into a bookshelf about 6 feet. And so I called the spiritual teacher, someone who had run the retreat, and she really was very helpful, and she said to stop meditating. And I think that was some of the best advice I've ever had. And she also had a very feminine quality. I mean, she wasn't this, I feel like there's a really hypo-masculine kind of quality in Aurobindo. And I feel like maybe the mother tempered some of that in the ashram. Because I know that the mentor who counseled me, she asked me about it, and I had a dream, and I told her about the dream. She recognized there was a character in the dream that was a feminine, very feminine power, very angelic being that had given me a message. And she told me to pay attention to that message. And I just sort of needed that kind of support. So I was lucky that I got the support and that I called the right person at the right time. But I don't think everyone in our culture is so lucky. And I think these kinds of experiences can end up in an emergency room, and people can get medicated, and which is the worst thing in the world if you have these experiences, to treat them like a pathology. So I think that I don't think Aurobindo is exaggerating, but once again, I think he's coming from working with highly functioning adults. Probably at their best, who can handle these kinds of influxes. But I think that if you live in a culture such as ours, and with its widespread dysfunction and post-traumatic stress and all kinds of, and you know, just the regular multiple personalities that everybody in this culture seems to have to deal with, because you have so many exaggerated demands placed on persons. I think that, you know, if there's anything in the childhood development that was dysfunctional, that these spiritual experiences will amplify that. And I think, you know, good practitioners need to be to know the difference between if you need therapy or you need to do more spiritual practice. And I think those are the kind of sophisticated decisions that many of us are able to make now through bitter experience. So I'm just putting that out there. I believe that these energies are, I don't think they have all the answers. And I think he's a little bit harsh. I think it's not just because we're ignorant that sometimes these we get tipped into directions that appear to be unhealthy. Because I think we're being experimented with. I don't know that there's just a, I think these energies, they don't want to hurt us, but I think there's a demand that they're interested in exploring us, this structure, this human experience. And this is, and I think we're being rewired psychically. And I think also our sexuality is being rewired. And I believe that my experience has not been like Aurobindo's. There was no clear, pristine descent, a descent from above. I think for me, it was definitely something coming up from below, but also in many different, you know, it's not neat, clean, pristine. So I'm just putting that out there as my personal experience, that I think this is a deconstructing power. It breaks you down, and hopefully you're going to go into a reconstructive phase, and then there may be a great benefit that may come from that. But I know the greatest teacher I ever had was the little old lady that I took care of, and when she died, I was with her, and I was the only one who, you know, her family wasn't there, and it was a very mysterious process. I was just alone with her, and I saw something quite spectacular happen to this little lady. And she, and I feel like a great transmission was, she transmitted something of enormous depth to me, and no spiritual teacher has ever come close to doing. So I think those kind of experiences are probably, you can't make plans for those kind of experiences, but when they come along, we're very grateful. So anyway, I'm just sharing that with you guys. This is not for the pleasure seekers or those who seek enlightenment. I would say stay home, go back. I think the dangers are very, very real. But you know, if these happen, if they spontaneously occur, I think there's help you can get. There are a lot of people out there who've made careers out of putting people back together. I think probably you guys know more about this than I do, but I think it sounds like Groff and people like that, working with spiritual emergencies. But I feel very, very blessed right now, and I feel like there's not that much turbulence going on, although a couple of years ago it wasn't true. There was a great deal of turbulence, but I feel like it comes in waves. It comes in waves, sometimes extremely turbulent, very chaotic. Then for years, it can be just totally blissful and be very easy and very smooth. But then there comes another wave. So I feel like there's the ascending and the descending currents. It can be really a bumpy ride sometimes. So I was hoping that I would hear people talk about something like that, dealing with the shadow, I really appreciate why people don't want to talk about that, because I don't want to talk about it either. But anyway, thanks,
John. I totally think that. Can you guys hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, I hear you, Lauren.
Cool. I like what you're saying, and I think you're right. It is important to talk about the shadow side. And what you said brought up two things specifically for me. And one, you're talking about being with your friend as she passed away, and it just like brought this memory right back up of when my grandmother died. And a week before she died, my neighbor, who was like a second mother to me, passed away kind of unexpectedly. And the last time I had been in town, I wanted to go see her, and I just completely spaced it. I was not connected in the moment, and I didn't say bye to her. And I left, and I was like all the way up in Santa Barbara, heading towards Santa Cruz, when I realized that I didn't get to say bye to her. And I was like, man, I wish I had. Maybe I should turn around. No, I'm too far. So I kept going. And then a little while later, my mom called me to tell me that she had passed away. And it was just devastating, knowing that I could have gone to see her, but I didn't. I chose not to. And I wasn't connected enough to what I was really feeling, like what my psychic being was telling me. And so when she told me that my neighbor had died, I immediately realized that my grandmother had been in bad condition for about a year, and she was bedridden and had somebody taking care of her with my mom and my aunt every day. And so I decided I had to go and see her immediately. I was in school, so I had to wait a few days, but the first thing I did was drive down to Southern California to see her. And I brought my friend Nastasia with me, and we got to Laguna, and we'd been driving all night. We got there in the morning, and we decided we needed to just ground our energy after being in the car for so long. So we went to the beach, and I was sitting there on the rock, and I closed my eyes for a second, and I felt the boundaries between my body and the world dissolve. And I heard my grandmother tell me to come right now. And I had this beautiful memory of her, and she was, and I just like jumped up, and I'm like, we have to go right now. And we get to her house, and within an hour of us being there, she passed away. And one of the craziest parts too is like, when we got there, like that day was a just perfect day. It was totally clear skies, beautiful, no wind or anything. And the moment we got to her house, the wind picked up like so intensely. It was pushing against the windows of the house. You know, you could like feel the house rattling with the wind. And I was just standing there with, I feel like my friend Nastasia was like holding space for my mother, my aunt, and I while we witnessed my grandmother passing away. She was just like standing there with her hands open to her sides, like being grounded for all of us. And I saw my grandma pass away. It was like a physical thing. I could witness, I was witnessing it happen. And like I could see this like energy like swirling around her. And I just immediately went. I didn't even know really what I was doing. It was like my psychic being was just taking control. And I went and grabbed my sage and some Palo Santo. And I started just doing this little ritual over her and like calling in the directions and asking for guidance for her spirit through this passage. And after she was gone, we stayed around for a little bit, and then we got into my car to go, and I turned on my iPod and it was on shuffle, and the next song started playing, and it was a Grateful Dead song called Black Peter, and it's about a old man who's dying, and basically nobody's paying attention until he's about to die, and everyone's like, just go run and see. And in the song, it was like this eerie, I mean, I get chills when I think about it, because the lyrics, he says how the weather down here is so fine in the town that he lives in, and then just as he's beginning to die, the song goes, and then the wind came rolling through the town, just like what happened that day, that being still and then getting extremely windy. And it was like the wind was like her spirit, like carrying her away, or something more powerful, like coming and being with us during that transition. It was one of the most beautiful experiences of my life, and I didn't cry because I was like, I was there to witness her passing, unlike all my other family members and my neighbor who had passed away that I didn't get to say goodbye to. Later, I ended up having some really amazing experience on ayahuasca, actually being held by my grandmother, by her spirit or something. It felt like she was holding me, and I got to cry and tell her how much I missed her. And she reminded me that she's been with me ever since as a spirit guide. And I feel that. I feel her being there and keeping me safe, like when I have near-death experiences and I feel like I have like angels watching out for me or something. And I feel like she's one of those people who's with me. And so and the other thing that you were talking about, which made me feel brought up a lot for me, my brother and I both have epilepsy. He had it way worse. He's recently, the last few years, had a brain surgery, and he has not had any seizures since. But it was a really big ordeal for my family. I only started having them when I got into high school, and I've only had a few in my life. I'm currently on medication so that I can drive and all that, because that's the way the law works around it. I have a seizure when I was a child. I don't know, I was six or something. And I didn't know what a seizure was. I had no idea what was to him. When I saw him, the feeling was that he was trapped in his body and couldn't get, something was trying to take over his consciousness and his experience in that moment. And he couldn't. He wasn't the dominant energy within his own body. He was like fighting something. And I like thought he was possessed, and I didn't even really know anything about this. It was like, that was just this feeling that I had, was that like there was something possessing him. And way later in my adult life, I came across this book. I wish I could remember the name of it right now. But it's really fascinating. It's a collection of different stories about healing and shamanic journeying and things like that. And one of them is about this doctor, I think he worked in Peru. I'm not really certain. It's been a little while since I've read this, but he was practicing for a long time and through the 90s. And he was bringing people who had epilepsy, who had, what were some of the other things? I think like multiple personality disorder and schizophrenia. And he was working with these people under the like assumption that they are actually highly psychic beings. They could be healers. They could be shamans. They could be psychics. Like these are powerful beings, and our culture doesn't know how to deal with that. We don't have the framework to recognize that these people have great potential and they're special. Healing States, that's the book. It's called Healing States. And so he works with them on training them through traditional methods, like from native peoples there, training them to be psychic. And they the whole program, he found, only worked if the person was willing to come down with their family members, because most of the time, like you said, John, it's built around a trauma that happens potentially. Maybe it's even a trauma in a past life. But to have the family there with the person as they're training, and the family goes through the psychic training as well, so they can all be on the same page. And as long as they have their family and they completed the training, they came out of it completely healed of their, quote, disorders. and fully trained psychics, and a lot of them chose not to follow that path. Like you were saying, John, when your friend was like, don't meditate, they found that it was better for them to be able to control it, but not to enter that state of consciousness. I'm extremely fascinating. And, you know, obviously, like, multiple personality and schizophrenia, I feel like, are two more extreme versions. Like, I feel like with epilepsy, the person's still partially in control. They're at least, like, still there in the body. But I feel like with somebody who's multiple personality or schizophrenic, it's just, like, they're fully taken over by some other entity. Like, and that's the thing. If you're highly psychic and you're in our world today,
I think you don't have that help. Yeah, that's true. I think there's a consortium of intelligences that I'm in relationship with. And I do believe that there are angelic beings. And I think you come into this is my myth. This is, I'm borrowing something from this writer, Tom Cheatham, who writes a lot on the Sufi tradition. He writes a lot about it, Henry Corbin as well. But I think there's this belief that you come into the world with an angel, and that angel is with you. And I've met mine, and I'm very happy that I know that that's who's coming to pick me up at the end of this lifetime. And I have no doubts about that at all. So I can endure a great deal because I know that I'm signed, sealed, and delivered to this beloved. But I think a lot of our yearning is misunderstood in this life because we are looking for that special person who's going to connect us. But that may not be on this plane. There may be other dimensions where that beloved is. And only on special occasions, sometimes when there's trauma, does that presence come forward. But at any rate, I do think just being an ordinary person and chopping wood and carrying water and doing the best you can from day to day is sometimes heroic and more than enough. So I love Aurobindo, but I think he gets a little hyper-masculine. I sort of think a more feminine, gentle, being gentle with oneself and with others is could be sometimes what's most required, because sometimes these openings can be, you know, quite traumatic, and but necessary. I do believe these are cleansing, and there's a lot of toxicity that is cleansed from the system psychically and physically. So I do think we have these immense powers that we're only just starting to take responsibility for. And I do think there are some wonderful people out there who've done some exquisite research, like the last time I was quoting from The Future of the Body. I think that's a wonderful book for finding ways of integrating these experiences. And of course, there's the Essen community, and there are other communities that sort of specialize, sort of like little ashrams. I love what you've said, Lauren, and I've loved what everyone has said. And thank you all very much for this opportunity to share at this level. Thank you. I think we're 5 minutes over 10 o'clock. Some of us may have things to do, so.
Yeah, let's call it a night. Thank you, Marco, for summarizing and leading off the discussion.
Yes, thank you, Marco. Thank you all very much.
You're thanks, welcome. Marco Mazzi. And bye.
Tony Sava.
Bye, Doug. Bye, Lauren. Bye, John.
Bye, 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 y'all. Bye, bye.
Thank you.